Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Today on the program, we'll have a couple of discussions on the topic of civil discourse and about the roots of civility's decline.
Money, the amount of money in politics has led to a point where incivility is inbred.
We'll hear from the Catholic Diocese of Cheyenne about justice for child sexual abuse victims in Wyoming.
The church has a mission to protect and heal the least.
And we'll learn more about a small brown insect that could disappear with climate change.
Icy stream habitat goes away. This whole world goes away.
Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. A Pennsylvania grand jury report found that leaders in the Roman Catholic Church there persuaded victims not to report sexual abuse and convinced law enforcement not to investigate it either. News of the cover-up, which protected over 300 abusive clergy, has sparked a call for increased accountability nationwide. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson takes a look at what's happening in Wyoming.
In early July, Stephen Bigler, bishop of the Cheyenne Diocese, publicly announced in a press release that Joseph Hart was under investigation by the Cheyenne Police Department for sexual abuse. Hart served as Wyoming's bishop from 1978 until 2001. Bigler also asked that a letter be read during Mass in all of Wyoming's parishes. He says he wanted to be transparent.
Part of the reason for transparency is then to prevent any possible further harm, if there's any possibility of that whatsoever. Because we know other places were not transparent, because they were not, more people were harmed.
A month and a half after Bigler's announcement, the national news erupted with stories of rampant sexual abuse by Catholic clergy in Pennsylvania.
Alleging a cover-up of Catholic priest sex abuses dating
back to the first statewide report will reveal accusations against more than 300 so-called predator priests.
300 pedophile priests and 1,000-plus victims in Pennsylvania.
Bigler says he's concerned that people have this impression that the large-scale cover-up in Pennsylvania is happening everywhere.
It's not at all accurate. More the norm is that bishops are doing their best to really do this well. That's my experience.
But he admits there are some real barriers to justice. When Bigler took his post in Wyoming a little over a year ago, he says his predecessor, Bishop Paul Etchen, told him about previous allegations against Joseph Hart and encouraged him to continue to pursue accountability and healing. Hart, who's in his 80s and still lives in Cheyenne, had been accused of child sexual abuse in Wyoming, as well as Kansas City, where he previously served as a priest. But he'd never been criminally charged. According to Bigler, in 2002, a victim called the Cheyenne Police Department to report Hart. At the time, the police were unable to obtain a full interview with the victim and closed the case for lack of evidence. But a settlement paid by the Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese in 2008 for a suit involving several accused clergy, including Hart, brought the issue to the surface again. Family members of the victim, whose report had gone nowhere, approached the diocese.
And they said, when will something be done?
Bigler says that's when Etchen turned to the Vatican.
So he actually wrote to Rome in 2010 and asked them to open an investigation. He did some activity. He tried to move this case forward.
The Cheyenne Diocese put restrictions on Hart's public activities as a clergy member, but outside of Wyoming, no further action was taken by the Catholic Church. And that's where things stood until Bigler took over as bishop 15 months ago.
There was no resolution of guilt or innocence, and so we felt that clarity needed to be found, for number one. And secondly, the church has a mission to protect and heal the least.
6 months into his new position, he initiated an investigation and was able to sit down for a longer conversation with the individual who reported Hart back in 2002. With his permission, a transcript of the conversation was shared with law enforcement. The Cheyenne PD has since opened a case, according to Officer Dan Long.
As of right now, I know that the investigation is still ongoing and that our Cheyenne Police Department detectives are still working the case.
Since then, two more men have come forward to report being abused by Hart as kids, and Bigler is hoping the case is gaining traction. But he's also heard some pushback.
People criticize us for making a press release when the investigation of the civil authorities was still underway.
Hart's lawyer, Tom Jubin, issued a press release saying, quote, "The Diocese of Cheyenne is engaging in a smear campaign," close quote. Jubin declined to comment further. Following the 2002 sexual abuse scandal in Boston, portrayed in the movie Spotlight, all dioceses were required to set up review boards comprised of community members with experience responding to sexual abuse. Wyoming's board, that's looking at this case, includes educators, mental health professionals, and community leaders, as well as Laramie County Circuit Court Judge Antoinette Williams. The board works with the bishop to review allegations and to notify the public. But Tim Lennon, president of the Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests, says justice can't be left up to the Catholic Church and local law enforcement.
This cannot be just for the moment kind of investigation where the church controls the information. We need true independence. We need something that has power.
His organization is calling for grand jury investigations like Pennsylvania's in all 50 states. Wyoming statute gives the attorney general and the governor authority to convene a statewide grand jury if it's deemed to be in the public's interest. At this time, Governor Matt Mead is not publicly considering a statewide grand jury investigation, nor is Attorney General Peter Michael. But Bigler says he's committed to seeking justice, and he's heard from survivors who've noticed his efforts. One woman wrote him a 5-page letter.
She wrote to me and she said, "You don't know what it means as a victim for me to hear the actions you're taking." What victims want, she said, is they want someone to defend them. And so it's a greater good that we're doing, not just for the particular case at hand, but to speak into the culture regarding this situation.
He hopes the investigation has benefits beyond the case against former Bishop Hart. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
A federal district court judge recently heard both sides in a hearing debating whether to put the greater Yellowstone ecosystem grizzly bear back under federal protection. No decision has been made yet, but the judge stalled Wyoming and Idaho's grizzly hunt for a couple of weeks while he decides the case. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska breaks down the arguments.
This is a complicated issue that digs deep into the nitty-gritty of the law, policy, and regulations of the Endangered Species Act, or the ESA. But here are two issues that are the heart of the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem Grizzly Bear case, also known as the GYE Grizzly. The first, the definition of recovery.
I wouldn't say the Yellowstone grizzly bear population is recovered.
That's Andrea Sansiri. She's an attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity.
I don't think that's the way we should be looking at things. I don't think we should be looking at this piecemeal, well, maybe they're recovered here.
Conservation and tribal groups argue the ESA doesn't call for just one segment of the historical grizzly bear range to be recovered, but rather the much larger area that encompasses several states. Brian Nesvik is the chief game warden for Wyoming Game and Fish. He says the conservative estimate of 750 grizzlies in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem is well over the ESA requirement to be recovered.
The Endangered Species Act contemplates that when a species is recovered, it should revert to state management. It doesn't contemplate protections long into the future, even following recovery.
For the state of Wyoming, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and other defendants, there is no question that the GYE grizzlies are recovered. And because of the way the ESA works, this means it's time for the states to take over management. This is the second issue at the heart of the case. Who should manage the grizzlies, the state or federal government? Cody Wisniewski is an attorney representing Wyoming farmers and ranchers. He says for his clients, grizzlies are posing a real threat to their way of living.
The grizzly bears, if they get into a sheep pen, will take out an entire flock of sheep. They don't leave anything standing. So not only is it catastrophic losses, but it's also just a fierce safety concern.
Since the bear was delisted a year ago, those conflicts are being handled at the local level, which is what they prefer.
Dealing with the federal government is never an enjoyable experience. But, you know, they would much rather have the opportunity to go to their local warden or work with their elected officials, as they should be able to address the population that lives in the state's borders, in their backyards.
Wisniewski says effective local management is best. Stan Seery of the Center for Biological Diversity disagrees.
We now see what that management will look like, catering and bowing down to the trophy hunters in this country.
Stan Seery says under federal management, states are not ignored. The state's input is considered. For the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, consideration isn't always enough. Dr. Chuck Preston is the curator of the Draper Natural History Museum at the Center of the West in Cody. He says somehow a balance needs to be found between local and national interest.
It comes down to a matter of trust. Do we trust these local states who have vested political interests beyond the grizzly bear itself? Can we trust them to manage this?
Preston says, unfortunately, wildlife management is not just about the animal.
A relatively small portion of wildlife science and a big part of people and understanding people, culture and cultural values.
Ultimately, Wyoming feels it has the right to manage grizzlies because of how much they invested in the bears, and a big percentage of the bears live within its borders. And they also think they'll do a good job, which they think they've proven the two times the bear has been delisted. But opponents believe if control is given to Wyoming, the state will kill bears without worrying about keeping their numbers at sustainable levels. The judge is expected to issue a ruling on the grizzly status in the next few days. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Coming up, Wyoming's congressional delegation weighs in on the Supreme Court nominee and a conversation with Alexander Heffner of the PBS program, The Open Mind. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. This week, Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh faced a grilling in his Senate confirmation hearings. But those hearings haven't garnered much national headlines about his knowledge, or lack thereof, of Western issues. Correspondent Matt Laszlo caught up with the Wyoming congressional delegation to see what they think of his abilities.
While the rest of us are confined to watching Kavanaugh perform under the hot lights of marathon hearings, and sometimes even hotter questions from skeptical senators, any U.S. senator can meet with him privately if they want. And both of Wyoming's senators took advantage of that access to the man who is expected to tilt the balance of the high court in a conservative direction. Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi says he's been impressed with the nominee.
An outstanding encyclopedic memory, congenial, well-informed, and a constitutionalist.
As for how he thinks Kavanaugh will rule on Western issues, Enzi says the Maryland native has convinced him he understands issues beyond the Mississippi River.
He's not allowed to talk about any speculation or that sort of thing. So I do know that he knows the West, and he even knows Gorsuch's mother, who was born in Casper.
Wyoming's junior senator John Barrasso also praises the nominee. As for how Kavanaugh will rule on issues vital to the state's economy and environmental health, Barrasso avoided all specifics, but offered this high praise.
I think he's going to be very good for Wyoming and Wyoming issues because he is somebody that applies the law, doesn't try to legislate from the bench, knows what the words of the Constitution says, understands the Constitution is a legal document, not a living document, built for certainty.
While most Republicans are avoiding discussing how they think Kavanaugh will rule on issues important to their base, Democrats are eager to discuss his hundreds of thousands of pages of rulings, emails, and other writings at their disposal. Here's the number two Democrat in the Senate, Dick Durbin of Illinois.
Well, he consistently rules on behalf of corporations and against the regulatory authority of the government.
Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse is arguably the nation's leading voice in Congress calling for action to combat climate change. He says Kavanaugh seems like a mere pawn for the oil and gas industry.
It promises to line up with the Republican majority only. 5-4 and related decisions that seem to do their best to try to help the big polluters who are in turn big funders of the Republican Party.
Kavanaugh is known for opposing what's been dubbed the administrative state, a theory that contends the executive branch and all the unelected federal workers in it have become too powerful. White House fears a Justice Kavanaugh will help undo the power Congress has given to experts at, say, the EPA, to write rules based on sound science.
I mean, there's a reason we set up expert agencies to do this stuff, and the forces that they regulate would love to see that expertise disappear and to have a politically tame Congress take over those responsibilities, and that would be a terrible, terrible place for the country to go.
Republicans in Congress and the Trump administration have been focused on winding back control from unelected federal workers. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says Congress has ceded its lawmaking powers over the years, and she's been a part of trying to get some of that power back, so she welcomes any allies in the cause.
We make law, and we've watched administrative agencies too often promulgate regulation that is inconsistent with the law we've made.
Still, Cheney knew Kavanaugh from back when her dad was vice president and has disagreed with some of his rulings. She says she especially disagreed with his district court ruling that Osama bin Laden's driver should have been given due process.
Fundamentally, I think that we should not have set up a situation, and frankly, I don't think we did set up a situation where detainees had the right to due process, where enemy combatants of the United States are enemy combatants, and that's how they ought to be treated.
Still, Cheney says she fully supports Kavanaugh.
But I tell you that as an example to say I don't agree with everything he's done, obviously, but I can't imagine anybody who'd be a better nominee for this position.
Most all Democrats will be spending the next few weeks trying to do everything they can to derail Kavanaugh's nomination, while Wyoming lawmakers will be doing everything they can to put the 53-year-old on the Supreme Court for life. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
On Tuesday, the current host of the long-running PBS program, An Open Mind, will give a keynote talk on the topic of civil discourse. Alexander Heffner is bringing his traveling discussion called Civil Discourse in an Uncivil Age, the Quest for a Postpartisan Citizenship, to Laramie. The event, which is free and open to the public, will start at 5:30 in the evening in the College of Arts and Sciences auditorium on campus. He tells us what his discussion will be about.
Well, I've had some of these really impressive practitioners of democracy on The Open Mind, which you can find at theopenmind.com. Of course, first and foremost, if you're concerned with the way that your school board or your county or your parish or your state is being governed, then you ought to get in the ring, either as an advocate or a candidate yourself. Of course, the traditional mechanisms for engaging in the revitalization of our democracy include direct engagement with those elected officials through town hall meetings, through electronic communications, petitions. You would think with the democratization of the internet, it's made things, on the one hand, to appear to be more transparent. On the other hand, there are folks who've just gone deeper into their shells, and a record number of people doing town halls by invitation only, other folks who are blocking, elected officials who are blocking constituents from commenting or accessing their Twitter pages. These are the obstacles we're facing now. To answer your question, I think you've seen a record number of young people running for office this cycle, record number of women running for office. They are standing up in the marches that we've had really the resurgence of hate and hate mongering. I see, I think, the signs of the revitalization of our democracy. I think you want to talk more about the presentation about civil discourse and our search for a postpartisan era, which I'm happy to do. The focus of my work on The Open Mind has been to reveal to the public how technologies in many instances have degraded our democracy and what are solutions for how especially the technology companies can wake up to the degradation of our discourse in democracy. And I describe the current internet as one that is open to free speech, but the classification system of what is true and false has gotten distorted. Monetizing disinformation and misinformation, and in effect saying we are going to abdicate any responsibility when it comes to the moral transgressions that are committed in these domains and platforms. And so I think that if we want to achieve a lasting civil society, we have to look at the origin of civilization. It means civil discourse. It means civil disobedience. It means a civil process. That idea of civility should apply to every kind of exchange in democratic lore. People are losing the meaning. Civil society can be synonymous with free and open exchange, but you get the democracy or the government that you ask for. If you are not committed to principles of civil society, then your government isn't going to reflect the better angels of our being, but the worst demons. And so that's what I'll be expounding on in the course of the presentation.
And you'll be here. You'll have some panelists as well who will join you. And Alexander Heffner, again, will be here September 11th at ANS Auditorium right here in Laramie. It's been a pleasure, and good luck with the program, and we'll see you then.
Thank you. Look forward to it.
Again, the discussion will include a local panel who will follow up on these points Tuesday at 5:30. Later in the program, four respected Wyoming officials will also discuss civil discourse. But coming up next, we'll have a story about an insect being impacted by climate change. This is Open Spaces. You are listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Scientists know very little about a species of stonefly that can only be found in the Grand Teton's alpine streams. The Lednia titanica was discovered in 2012. But as climate change slowly melts glaciers and threatens the aquatic insect's habitat, researchers are trying to learn as much as they can about the species before it disappears. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim has more.
On a cold morning at a Grand Teton campground, three scientists are packing their bags for an expedition.
It's about 6 a.m. People are just starting to wake up, and we're heading to the Skillet Glacier later today.
That's Scott Hotelling, a postdoctoral scholar at Washington State University. He's alongside Lesha Tronstadt.
I'm the invertebrate zoologist at the University of Wyoming.
These scientists and a graduate student have been visiting sites around the Tetons for over a week, collecting data on a stonefly species unique to the mountain range, the Lednia titanica. The small brown aquatic fly lives only in rock and surface glacier-fed streams. In the first leg of their journey to today's site, Skillet Glacier, the team jumps on a boat. For the last 4 years, a small group of researchers, including Tronstadt and Hotelling, has been racing to study the insect and the streams it lives in.
See the little handle going up?
It looks like a snow guitar.
Yeah, it's a snow guitar. And there's the stream coming out of it that we'll be walking up.
Okay, you guys ready?
Very little is known about what lives in these alpine streams. These scientists are the first people to really investigate what's there.
We call ourselves the Alpine Stream Dream Team.
And they think what they find might be important. With climate change heating up temperatures in the insect's habitat, the rush to learn about it pushes the stakes even higher.
Icy stream habitat goes away. This whole world goes away and is replaced by a warmer temperature community that is different. And that's a significant blow to global biodiversity.
After the short boat ride, the scientists head upward on the long, trailless hike. Hotelling explains after today and many more days like it, the team will have a huge collection of the basic natural history of the species, the insect's population density, the microbes in the water, and how the temperature changes annually.
We need these long-term data sets to fully clarify how these changes are happening on a year-to-year basis. Or a decade to decade.
Already, the team has uncovered 9 new sites where the stonefly lives, out of only 10. After hours of bushwhacking through willows and climbing over boulders, the alpine streams come into view. Soon, Hotelling lifts up a rock and uncovers a small brown wriggling insect.
All right, here's one of the stars of our alpine stream show. This is Lednia tetonica right here. You see this little dark brown stonefly?
The insect clings to rocks as freezing water rushes past it. It's the size of an ant, and sort of nondescript. Tronstadt explains this stonefly is important to its ecosystem by dealing with big organic matter like leaves, sticks, and moss.
And they usually shred those up and make them into smaller pieces, and other organisms can use them downstream, so...
They're also important because, as an indicator species, it's like a canary in a coal mine. As stoneflies start going away with warming waters, that means climate change could be having other impacts in the alpine stream ecosystem, and that affects water everywhere.
These are the headwaters of the world, and so everything that happens up here, all the organisms that live and die, all the water that flows out of a glacier, it all goes into Jackson Lake down here, and it continues until it goes out into the world's oceans.
Hotelling moves up and down the stream in search of 20 lednia to study later. Further down, the graduate student is brushing stones from the stream, collecting algae, fungi, and bacteria. Over time, her research will show how lednia food sources could be changing with the climate. 10 feet away, Tronstadt gathers data on the stream.
I was saying that there wasn't a lot of algae in the stream. It was, you guys concurred.
She notes how much algae is in the stonefly's habitat, what rock sizes are there, pH, as well as what other insects are present to learn population density. While they still can, scientists are collecting this baseline data and will watch over the course of years as climate change transforms this world.
And watching, waiting, and collecting data every year is really the best thing we can do to figure out how this is all going to play out and end.
The next morning, after a steep downward hike from Skillet Glacier, a new question around the stoneflies is being addressed. If it can withstand warmer temperatures, some scientists have already learned it can, though not well. Hotelling says it's one more question they'll have to take on, and that's no problem.
We'll be back. I mean, that's definitely the only constant is we will show up next year.
There's more to learn about this tiny brown alpine species, and it could have bigger implications than the tiny stonefly itself. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
With rising global temperatures, glaciers are shrinking. Garrett Fisher is a pilot and a photographer, and he recently set out to capture all of the glaciers in the Rocky Mountains while flying his plane, a two-seater built in 1949. His new book, Glaciers of the Rockies, is the result of the effort, and he told Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard that there's something different about seeing the world from above.
Even among pilots, they all know there's something magical about flying a Cub, that they call it low and slow. You have the side door open if you want. You're looking almost down to your right, and there's the wheel, and you can look down at farms, and you can literally smell pine trees. I've smelled people's barbecue. You can smell the desert sage in the open range. You're kind of that close and going so much slower that even in the world of small planes, this airplane's going the speed of a car, and you notice just about everything.
How did you get interested in photographing glaciers in the Rocky Mountains?
So that kind of starts, honestly, back in New York, of all places. I was a late teenager. One of my friends, who literally would read dictionaries for entertainment, had discovered one of the early studies that came out about the glaciers in Glacier National Park, that they were anticipated, according to the calculations at the time, now we're talking late 1990s, the calculations indicated possibly 2030 that all the glaciers would be gone. Now, granted, I've never been out to the Rockies. We just had this sort of deep connection of I've got to see them if they're going to disappear. And that sort of just sat on a shelf. Life got in the way, wandered around for careers and whatnot. And then eventually, 15 to 17 years later, I ended up living in western Wyoming in Alpine with the plane. And it just was a foregone conclusion. If I'm going to be in Wyoming, it started at least, I'm going to fly the glaciers of Wyoming. It's just a no-brainer. And then the project from there grew into, well, all of them in the Rockies.
Once you had started this project, was there a sense of urgency to see and photograph these glaciers?
There were two pieces of urgency. The one was I wanted to do it when the snow was melted off. It's kind of pointless to photo a glacier after a snowstorm because it may end up looking just like the rest of the mountain range. So I had a limited window I knew enough from Colorado that the glaciers would probably melt off roughly about end of July. You'd start seeing the textures, which is where the real value shows up. You're looking at centuries of snowfall as showing itself. Roughly at about that moment, then the entire West started on fire. And then I was initially in the project just going to do Wyoming. I said, well, this is a bit crazy. I've got a limited window. And I said, I just don't know if I can really stomach getting Montana this year. And then in separate factors, we had an opportunity to move to Europe. And I literally was faced with the question, will I be back here with the plane before they all melt? And I figured the answer was probably not. And even if so, how much would I have missed? So that created a sort of crazed, menacing run to finish it as fast as I could. I was literally outrunning smoke coming up from the south and incoming snows to the north when I got the last of them at the end of September in Glacier National Park.
How do you fly a plane and photograph glaciers or natural features at the same time?
So in short, it's the left hand is on the stick and the right hand is on the camera. As far as actual flying, most people are sort of enthralled by that prospect. I can say this, it's similar to a car. If you kind of look out the window, you'll start drifting. In the plane, you'll go about just as far off course, maybe 8-9 feet off course in a second and a half, but there's nothing there.
Do you think there's a different perspective to be gained from seeing these features from the air as opposed to, you know, driving through Yellowstone in your car?
I think definitely. So I find that when you can get with about 700-800 feet and have a three-dimensional perspective, I'm amazed at what is just past what you can see in the car. Just the local neighborhood, when we follow the path of least resistance to our daily routine, we're honoring zoning, private property, highways, thousands of variables we can't control and probably don't bother to think about, and therefore we could spend a decade living somewhere and never know what's behind something. And an airplane shows there's just always something amazing. Even in a suburban area, the craziest things people do, the craziest things they build. And of course, in nature, the stuff that's hiding just out of view, it's almost comical. There's so much to see in a place that it's befuddling to me, but at the same token, it drives me to do this sort of thing because I can offer something that people obviously are interested in. I mean, 4 million people go to Yellowstone every year. Just simply, no one could have the time to hike the whole park unless they were a park ranger. So this is sort of a way to at least bring something people love in a concise and useful way.
Garrett Fisher is a pilot and photographer. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
University of Wyoming President Lori Nichols recently set a goal of increasing the number of Native Americans attending UW, especially since enrollment of tribal members recently reached an all-time low. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner participated in the Native American Research Center's first-ever orientation. The goal was to make students comfortable from day one.
I hope this orientation is a big part of them being successful. I really hope that they can look back and say that it all started with the Native student orientation.
That is Renette Tendor. She is the Native American Program Advisor. Her office is housed in the new Native American Education, Research, and Cultural Center here in Laramie.
I, being an undergrad student from UW and also my grad school from here, I didn't have any of this community here, a student orientation myself. So when I'm always planning things, I'm always thinking of what's going to help us, what's going to help me, what would have helped me when I was a student.
This is the center's first fall semester and first orientation for new Native students. Some students are unsure of their major but are excited to be here in Laramie.
I'm Wolfstar Duran, and I have an undeclared major.
She's excited about potentially joining a sorority and taking all sorts of classes.
And then there's, like, swing dancing on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Like, I mean, that seems pretty fun.
This is Juwan Willow, another incoming freshman.
So moving to Laramie was interesting. packed up my car, said goodbye to the family, and they were all like, yeah, get out of here.
His major is social sciences and secondary education. He wants to be a teacher.
So throughout high school, I live on a reservation, and I go to a former BIA school. They're always taught by people who aren't necessarily Native American. And I saw that as kind of an issue, and so I was like, I want to be a teacher.
Faculty and staff from around campus came to welcome the new students. The line to present was out the door of the classroom. While the Native American Education, Research, and Cultural Center has only existed since October of last year, the impact has already been long-lasting.
My name is Taryn Jim, and I'm a senior majoring in speech, language, and hearing science. I'm minoring in disability studies and American Indian studies.
Taryn is graduating and hoping to get into grad school. She remembers not having the research center.
But then when we had this center, it was like I met so many people here, and we all just had, I don't know, we could just all relate to each other really easily. Well, myself personally, I just felt like I was lost because there was really just nowhere to go. There was really nowhere to hang out, no one to relate to from the reservation.
Taryn works on research funded by the Social Justice Research Center on top of being a mother and RSO president of Keepers of the Flame. She's also Northern Arapaho.
I guess like with this orientation, you could see that we're recruiting students, we're getting freshmen in, but at the same time, you know, there was just enough of us that just fit in the classroom. There should be a lot more Native Americans. I guess this house kind of points that out too, that there's not very many of us. But hopefully one day there will be a lot more of us.
That story was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner. When we come back, four well-known former Wyoming officials discuss the decline in civility. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The University of Wyoming's Haub School and the Ruckels House Institute recently celebrated 25 years of collaboration to solve problems concerning the environment and natural resources. As part of the festivities, the school hosted a panel on civility with some of Wyoming's most respected political figures, U.S. Senator Al Simpson, former Supreme Court Chief Justice Marilyn Kite, former U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director and State Senator John Turner, and former Governor Mike Sullivan. I sat down with them as part of our series, I Respectfully Disagree.
Al Simpson, retired U.S. Senator.
Marilyn Kite, retired Supreme Court Justice.
John Turner, retired from public service, living in Teton County.
Mike Sullivan, former Wyoming Governor.
Is this time worse than any other time that you have seen over the courses of your careers?
It is interesting that there was is dramatic incivility from the very beginning of this country. And there's a particular interchange between Jefferson and Adams that I thought about using, but I can't use any of the language because it's so inappropriate what they called each other. It's been bad for a long time. We seem to survive it. In my view, what's making it so bad now is just it's this constant 24/7 news cycle where they're yelling in your face, and you can't imagine that it has ever been like that before.
Right. I wonder, maybe, Al, if you might talk a little bit about how we might be able to overcome some of the partisanship.
Well, it comes out of campaigns. A lot of young people get in campaigns, and they're 20, and they're told, now, don't forget, hit the opponent between the eyes, and then they get elected and they go to Washington or Cheyenne and they're just as sharply edged as they were during the campaign. They have no background in legislating. They don't even know what the word is. Legislating is a very dry form of human endeavor, and there's nothing exciting about it, but they don't want that. They want the sound bite, and they want to charge and beat up Pelosi or beat up Schirmer or beat up McConnell. I mean, it's madness. And they never see each other, so that makes a difference. If you have your program where you put people together, in Washington, nobody ever sees anybody. They're out raising bucks, and anonymous bucks, dark money bucks. This was the last campaign full of that.
What would you say, you know, maybe an example of when you have saw real division and how you worked that out. Could you give an example?
Yeah, with me, when I find some guys after my butt, I say, why don't we have lunch together? And do it in the Irma Hotel where people can see that we're sitting down having lunch, and they'll walk in and say, what's Simpson doing with that jerk, or what's that jerk doing with Simpson, and talk.
I wonder if, you know, either of you, because you worked in kind of in with wildlife, which of course in Wyoming is often a very divisive subject.
Through my time in the legislature and working for two presidents, there's some wonderful examples of collaboration between ranchers and oil and gas, and coal, sportsmen, and environmentalists, where they, I think it all starts with building levels of trust. One that comes to mind is working on wolf reintroduction in the Rocky Mountains. It had been a stalemate for 20 or 30 years. We brought wool growers together with state people and sportsmen and all kinds of people. We tried to work with the West and meet their concerns about wolves. Unfortunately, due to the courts and some liberal activists, we haven't kept those promises. But at least we forged a coalition. That's gotten messy, but at least the initial coalition was bought into by people that said, I think this is something we can all work with.
Mike Sullivan, I wonder if you might be able to talk about, you were a Democratic governor in Wyoming, which sounds like a total contradiction nowadays. And I just wonder, you know, what that was like during the era that you were, you know, governor. How did you negotiate those partisanships, and what was the mood then?
In my view, in Wyoming, we're small enough and we're intimate enough in the best sense that there is a limit to how incivil we're willing to be. Now, we've crossed that limit recently on a few occasions, so it's not we're not out of the woods. But as a Democratic governor, as a governor, because there is certain tension between the executive and the legislative branches built into our system, so that you're always negotiating. If you provide trust, as John said, respect, you're willing to listen, and understand, it helps.
When Mike was governor and I was president of the Wyoming State Senate, as I think back, oil had dropped to $12 or $13 a barrel. The fiscal straits we were in were severe. We were far beyond cutting fat and muscle, we were into bone. And obviously, as a Democratic governor, Mike and his constituents had different priorities than some of my Republican colleagues, but early on we sat down. And the two of us agreed, we're not going to agree on all the pieces, but this is the target we're going to have to hit. And I went back to my caucus, and Mike talked to his colleague. But together, we reached the target by mutual trust, candor, and quietly we did it together.
Money, the amount of money in politics has led to a point where incivility is inbred. Because the money comes on the basis of a special interest. The special interest says we've got to defend this special interest to the death. And so we get the extremes on both sides, on the left and the right, and nobody moves. And their goal is to take somebody out. You either agree with me or you're on your way out. I'll get somebody to run against you and I'll fund them. And so politics has bred in the incivility.
Marilyn, I wonder if you might talk a little bit about just kind of looking forward into, you know, the way that we move into a more civil time, the way that we might be able to diversify and how that could help, bringing more women into public office and things like that.
It almost seems like to me that we need to have some kind of a bipartisan committee of civil leaders that could speak out and could react to some of what we see going on, because I'd like to think Wyoming's different, but it really isn't. I mean, the whole world's covered now by the instant media. While certainly some kind of diversity, additional diversity, whether it be racial diversity or gender diversity, economic diversity, would perhaps help some, but it still is, having to listen to each other and expecting that that is your job. It's sort of like maybe the silent majority needs to formally stand up. I'd love to have some kind of a, you know, civility commission made up of people that Wyoming respects that is willing to take a stand. I think we need somebody to pull the reins in. Maybe it's Al. What do you think,
Al? No, I was going to pull a rein around the horse. This diversity is a laugher to me because what I want to know is how it's possible for the National Football League to be 80% black. Now, by God, if you believe in diversity, we got to correct that. Why is this happening? It's because they're better. Now, that ought to light up a little torch somewhere. This is nuts. Absolutely nuts. Really, look at that. Yeah. And diversity is a fiction. It's a political correctness babble.
You know, what do you guys think about this this idea that she's got of kind of creating like some sort of a civility, you know, people who are willing to just kind of come out and be sort of the conscience or the you know, I just really like this idea.
I don't know if that makes any sense. All I know is we all have these conversations ourselves around our dinner tables, but you don't see it in the public discourse.
You'd like to think the people you elect to office would be your civility commission. And one of the areas that we're missing is we have both a leadership that you can argue is uncivil, and then we have a leadership that is willing to be silent and sit on their hands and make no reference when things are uncivil, that maybe that's not the way it should be.
You guys have all been in office, and I wonder if you can let people know, do they have a voice? Are they being heard? Can they make a difference?
This collaboration approach works very well on, it's not limited to local issues, but it's easier to implement on local issues. And where I think citizens can have maybe more of a role is to look at these models and encourage or lead the way on local issues. All this incivility goes right on down to school board elections and all of the local things going on. So I would say that's where we should focus.
I never had an unlisted number, and it was never really abused. But we're Wyoming, and so you go down the street, and you're not called senator. You just say, hey, Al, why'd you make that dumb vote on so-and-so? And you say, well, if you give me a minute, I'll describe why I did that. You may not like it, but you need to know that I had my brain engaged when I thought that that was my result to do. And I hope our legislators don't ever get to that, but I'm finding that they don't like to have town meetings. I mean, when you're afraid to have a town meeting in Wyoming, something's wrong. I had them all the time, and they were hot. I spoke for 5 minutes and stayed for 2 hours, and they were heated. But by God, they're paying your salary, and they want to air themselves, and you can't do that with a canned letter from a robo-vehicle.
I know a lot of people are struggling, like, in their own families right now. They might be disagreeing on really hot issues and not even wanting to have those conversations and just have stopped. But you guys have all had some really hard conversations where you're facing, you know, a whole audience full of people who might not agree with you. Any advice for some of those folks who are just dealing with how to talk about hard things?
One word, listen, and every one of us has said it.
You've all said that.
Listen, listen, and you make it enough for me.
Okay, no, I say the same thing. And listening to some of your programs, what's the name?
I respectfully disagree.
I respectfully disagree. Where there have been people with diametrically opposed emotional positions, and once they started listening one-on-one to each other, they softened. They may not have changed their mind, but they didn't, at the end of that effort, insult each other.
I think that's a good start, listening, but it involves developing respect for one another and even friendships. So many people I strongly disagree with are friends. And if you start out with a respect and friendship, you can do a lot together. But my advice to citizens, tune in, get informed, get involved, whether it's a school board election, town council, state legislator, whatever it is, get involved.
That was former U.S. Senator Al Simpson, former Supreme Court Chief Justice Marilyn Kite, former U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director and State Senator John Turner, and former Governor Mike Sullivan.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. You can hear this program, individual segments, or any of our shows on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
You can also sign up for our podcast on that site or find it where you normally get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.